Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading from the April-May 2025 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this article, The City Beneath the City. A journey into the vast subterranean world preserved under Rome, from ancient aqueducts and apartment buildings to pagan shrines. By Tony Perrottet. "Watch out for that bat behind you," warned Luca Messina, a civil engineer who moonlights as a splenio-archaeologist with Scotorani di Roma. Undergrounds of Rome, a local group whose members explore the darkest recesses of the Eternal City, I ducked as the winged mammal swooped past my ear, then flitted beyond the beam of my headlamp and disappeared in the void ahead. "Don't worry about those insects," Messina added, nodding to walls hewn 2,300 years ago, and which I now saw were crawling with spider-like crickets called Dolichopoda. "They aren't dangerous." Messina and I were standing in a sepulchral stretch of the Aqua Annio Vetus, one of the superbly crafted aqueducts that once channeled water into ancient Rome, built beginning in 272 BC, and dry for nearly 1,500 years. To some, this might be the stuff of nightmares and horror movies, but to me it was the start of an obsession with the city's last hidden corners. Earlier that morning, I'd met the half-dozen fellow expedition members from Soterrani di Roma, all self-taught adventurers like Messina, for a cappuccino and cornetto at one of the city's eastern metro stations. Chatting cheerfully in a nearby parking lot, we geared up in hard hats and headlamps, although some of the groups also had industrial steel-tipped boots and gray protective overalls bearing the association's logo, an artistic outline of an ancient amphora. A short drive took us into the surprisingly wild city surrounds known as the Roman Campagna, or countryside, where we hiked across empty fields of tall grass and purple flowers, each of us carrying scythe-like implements to cut our way through the underbrush. We're only a 20-minute drive from Rome, and it's like the Amazon rainforest, Messina said, laughing. After passing beneath the overgrown arch of the ancient Tulela Bridge, which loomed like a relic from an alien civilization, the eyes of the group members turned resolutely downward. Our popular image of Roman aqueducts is a monumental above-ground structure. They can be seen most vividly in the Park of the Aqueducts, where six meet southeast of the city, but the vast bulk of their roots were actually underground, engineered at a slight decline to use gravity to keep the water flowing. Over a period of some 500 years, from 312 BC to AD 226, 11 extraordinary aqueducts were built to supply the ancient city. 10 were cut when the Goths besieged Rome in AD 537, and today their tunnels still snake beneath the modern city and for miles around, although they have never been properly mapped. Locating them involves detective work and has attracted eccentric explorers since interest in antiquity was revived in the Renaissance. The most complete studies were done by the British archaeologist and scholar Thomas Ashby, who scoured the remotest corners of the Roman Campagna from 1906 to 1925, and produced a magisterial tome, The Aqueducts of Ancient Rome, which was published posthumously by his wife in 1935. Today, Messina and other intrepid members of Soterranei di Roma use modern technology to expand on Ashby's findings. Ashby mapped many aqueducts in detail, but he obviously had no GPS and couldn't cite precise locations, Messina said. So his descriptions include landmarks that no longer exist, farmhouses that have vanished, trails have changed course, buildings destroyed in the war. We try to identify the spots he found a century ago, map them with GPS systems, and post them on Google Earth. About 20 minutes later, Messina spotted a sippus, a low stone pillar placed during the reign of Augustus, the first emperor, every 240 Roman feet, 11.6 inches, to mark an aqueduct's subterranean course. There are thousands of them in the countryside, he said. Only God really knows how many. A nearby hole, hidden by branches, was an entrance to a vertical shaft, once used by skilled Roman teams called aquiari, to access the aqueducts for maintenance. Calcium deposits are a problem in aqueducts, affecting the flow, he noted. They're like espresso machines. You have to clean them. Ancient footholds remain carved into the walls of the shaft, but the group opted to use a portable wire ladder to descend the 25 feet. Soon I was standing in a smooth stone corridor that few people have entered for the last 15 centuries. With our headlamps lit, we clambered, hunched over for about 80 yards into the pitch darkness, which in Italian is referred to as il oblio, or oblivion. The air, which has not circulated for millennia, became stale. At one point, we scrambled over a pile of debris where part of the ceiling had caved in. It's very safe, Messina assured me. There has only been one collapse in 2,300 years, so we'd have to be very unlucky to be trapped. I gazed ahead as he mapped the space with a handheld 3D scanner. Keep going, he said with satisfaction, and you'd end up on Rome's Esquiline Hill. Descending into the Anio Vetus offered me a rare sense of discovery in one of the world's most heavily visited cities, whose famous antique treasures have been admired by medieval pilgrims, 18th-century grand tourists, English romantics, and contemporary Italophiles. Having first visited Rome more than two decades ago to research a book on ancient Roman tourists, I believed I had seen all the classical sites of note. But the adventure inside the aqueduct showed me that the city has a hidden dimension, and it is hardly the only subterranean site offering a fresh perspective on Rome's venerable grandeur, if you know where to look. Anyone who visits Imperial Rome's most renowned relics, the Colosseum, the Pantheon, the Temple of Saturn, notices that their foundations lie far below the level of the modern streets. Since the demise of the empire in the 5th century AD, the ancient city has been buried under some 30 feet of urban debris and construction, and the majority of it remains hidden under visitors' feet. In fact, there are enough subterranean spaces that regular street collapses swallow cars whole, making Rome the sinkhole capital of Europe, according to the London Times. But this has also turned the city into a paradise for a quirky new breed of speleo-archaeologists, inspired amateurs who work with academics to piece together a more complete map of how the imperial city has evolved over the last 3 millennia, revealing a fascinating multidimensional honeycomb of pagan shrines, public baths, hidden lakes, nymphiums, private baths of the rich adorned with seashells and faux forests, grand sewers, mining tunnels, Christian catacombs, and ossuaries. In a sense, it's Roman archaeology's final frontier. Many people think of Rome as a lost city, explains Giuseppina Mattietti, an earth scientist at George Mason University outside Washington, D.C., when I met her for lunch last summer on Isola Tiberina, the trireme-shaped island in the middle of the Tiber River. But that's the interesting thing. It's not gone. Romans just built on top of it for century after century. The Rome-born Mattietti, who has lived in the United States for some 30 years, has joined Soterranei di Roma on numerous adventures over the last 10 or so summers. Everything from crawling on elbows through tunnels beneath the Palatine Hill to wading through the Cloaca Maxima, the magnificent sewer that the first century AD scholar Pliny the Elder regarded as a marvel of engineering and still functions as an active part of the modern city's infrastructure. I had to wear a full hazmat suit and have shots for hepatitis, typhoid, cholera, she told me. Everything short of anthrax. I took them all. Descending through a malodorous entrance in the Roman Forum, the team waded through the sewer until the water current became too powerful. We had to proceed by digging sticks in the mud so we wouldn't be dragged under by the flow. That wasn't an experience I was keen to repeat, but luckily there are many other underground sites that are entirely accessible to travelers with some insider guidance, Mattietti said, and if they know about them. Every summer she takes students below the sidewalks of the historical center Centro Storico via little-known public museums like the Crypta Balbi, where visitors descend 40 feet from the busy modern street level of cafes and souvenir stores by the Piazza Venezia and the recently opened Roman houses of Celio, which includes a lavishly frescoed aristocratic villa from the 3rd century A.D. Many Christian churches also have haunting basement levels, most impressively the Basilica of San Clemente, where visitors end up in a mithraeum, an altar devoted to a pagan cult popular in the 1st century A.D. Ancient mosaics even turn up in the basement of restaurants like Pancrazio in the old Pompey's Theater, near where Julius Caesar was stabbed, while the walls of some bars in Testaccio have glass windows to reveal layers of broken clay amphorae discarded in antiquity. But many of Mattietti's favorite subterranean sites require some planning to visit, she said, since Rome's understaffed special superintendents of archaeology only opens them by special request. This involves calling a local number and often requires a modest minimum fee of about 40 euro. After lunch at Travestere, whose name comes from the Latin for across the Tiber, Mattietti led me to the Renaissance-era Palazzo Specchi and the Church of San Paolo alla Regola. Nothing indicated they were of unusual interest until a young custodian in the uniform of the superintendents arrived with an enormous rusty key, then unlocked a metal doorway into the palazzo's exterior to reveal worn stone stairs, lit by a bare bulb. We gazed down in silence for a moment, as if we were entering Tut's tomb. "We are used to seeing cities horizontally," Mattietti observed. "We talk about urban sprawl in spatial terms, but if we look at cities vertically, it creates a timeline, right back to when the first people said, 'This is a good place to live.'" The steps led 25 feet down into an insula, literally island, of or Roman apartment complex. Mattietti explained that this riverfront area of the Tiber in the 1st century A.D. was home to horse stables, shipping warehouses, and sacred oak groves. But by the 2nd century, the structures were taken over as residences by poor Romans, and they remained inhabited throughout the Middle Ages. The strata of archaeological remains in Rome are often compared to a lasagna, she added, with layer after layer piled on top of each other, but they also overlap. In the United States, we demolish old buildings and start over. In the ancient world, people reused them. Structures were built to last. Some underground sites were even repurposed in World War II as air raid shelters, including the basement at the 18th century Villa Torlonia, where Mussolini lived from 1925 to 1943. "There are 9 different types of walls here," she enthused, pointing out each different design, along with embedded terracotta pipes, fragments of marble, and a site where piles of shrimp shells were found. "Even such oddities are important to scholars," she said. "In fact, when we later walked by an overflowing garbage bin," she noted, "today's trash, tomorrow's archaeological site." Exploring humble dwellings provides a fuller image of Roman society, she argues. "When we look at the ruins of ancient Rome, we often see what its emperors and aristocratic rulers wanted us to see. The Colosseum, the forums, all the great monuments. But what about the real Romans, who made up 90% of the population and brought the city alive? They are part of the story, too. Why don't you come to the cave for pizza tonight?" Marco Placidi, a founding member of the Soterini di Roma, asked me when I inquired about his latest work. It was an irresistible offer. In 2020, Placidi said the group opened its headquarters in the Labyrinth of Rome, a vast network of tunnels that extends for some 22 miles between Caffarella Park, a green oasis in the southeast of the city, near the ancient Appian Way. The quarry was initially dug in the 1st century B.C., as a source for tuff, a volcanic rock that was pulverized as an ingredient for Roman concrete, the strong essential material used to construct the city's most illustrious architectural wonders. And so at dusk I followed Italian families walking their dogs along bucolic paths, through fields fringed with flowers, duck-filled lakes, and woodland, until I spotted the quarry's moss-covered entrance, where a half-dozen club members, including Mattiotti, were chatting at a table over boxed takeaway pizzas, olives, and wine. "My interest in the underground began organically," said Placidi, whose day job is as a work safety officer at a local energy company. "When a friend visited him, from out of town in the 1990s, they went on a tour of the most renowned Roman tourist sites. We were frustrated at how controlled things were," he said. "You couldn't even take photos in the Vatican Museum. so we decided to find more unusual, hidden places where we could experience the city more freely, walk where we wanted, touch things. And that very often brought us to hidden spots below Rome's surface. In 2000, he and a handful of fellow enthusiasts founded the first Spelio Archaeological Club, which split into two rival groups about a decade ago. We started pre-internet with 50 members, Placidi said. We now have 2,000 or so members, including Europeans, Americans, Japanese. Renting in the labyrinth of Rome at a nominal fee from its owners fulfilled one of Placidi's fantasies. Rome's Centro Storico is a web of bureaucracy, he lamented. When we work at sites there, we have to deal with the Superintendency of Archaeology, the Commune of Rome City Government, the Vatican, the water company Assia. But the quarry is privately owned, which gives us a lot of freedom. After the pizza, we descended into the tunnels, which were garlanded with electric lights for the first 100 or so yards. The association has converted several of the first rough-hewn chambers into meeting rooms, including a recreated mithraeum decorated with faux Roman statues surrounded by ferns, which members have dubbed La Bat Caverna. Every weekend they conduct walking tours and even lead groups on mountain bikes into the darkest recesses of the complex. Wandering deeper into the dank maze, we arrived at a metal ladder leading 20 feet up to a hole in the stone ceiling. In the Middle Ages, tomb raiders knew the quarry extended beneath an early Christian catacomb, Placidi said, so they dug upward. Another club member, a Spanish-born schoolteacher named Alfonso Diaz Boge, started climbing and beckoned me to follow as Placidi held the ladder steady. Soon I was crawling in the fetid darkness as my headlamp lit up niches filled with shards of pottery and Roman mosaics, and what I realized were human remains, including a skull. The grave robbers hoped to find treasure, Diaz Boge said. All they found were bones. I had been to several of the more official catacombs run by the church, many of which were impressive complexes. St. Sebastian was with a pagan basement with Medusa frescoes. St. Calixtus with its four underground levels. But somehow, squatting in the darkness with my hands and knees covered in grime, caught my imagination more. Some academics looked down on Soterana di Roma Association as amateurs, Mattiette said after she joined us, crouching in the musty alcove. But I think the members are like citizen scientists in the U.S. They are dedicated and deeply passionate. They do not get any glory out of it, certainly no money. They explore for the love of it. One veteran member I met had the letters SPQR tattooed on his wrist, the Latin motto of the ancient city, Senatus Populescis Romanus, the Senate and the people of Rome. The reality is that most academic archaeologists don't want to explore underground. They don't have the means, they don't have the training, and frankly, they don't want to kill themselves. News of other underground sites is passed on by word of mouth. For some time I'd heard rumors about lakes hidden beneath the Temple of Claudius on the Cilian Hill, in the very heart of the ancient city. It sounded like something out of a Jules Verne novel, but some Roman friends in the know tipped me off that visits are now organized by the city's other organization of Spelio Archaeologists, which has the confusingly similar name Roma Soterania, Rome Underground. And so the next afternoon I set off to find the ancient temple's entrance, which in the Middle Ages was cannibalized as part of the Church of Saints John and Paul. I promptly became lost, wandering around the church's ornate interior until a kindly sacristan in black robes took pity and led me to a metal grill by a courtyard, where a half dozen excited Romans were putting on hard hats. Built after Emperor Claudius's death in AD 54, the temple was once one of Imperial Rome's most extravagant pagan edifices, whose foundations measured some 600 by 650 feet, more than the area of two football fields. A young guide named Chiara Massimiani pointed out several of its monolithic columns still embedded in the church structure, then led us down steep metal steps to a rough-hewn opening. Instantly, the summer heat of Rome was replaced by the cold, clammy air of tunnels that, like the labyrinth of Rome, was first carved to mine tuff. We then entered a cavern containing the first of two small lakes filled with eerily blue, vodka-clear water. It was also biologically pure, Massimiani noted. Rainwater has dripped through 10 meters of stone above our heads, so all the impurities have been removed. She felt a civic pride that Rome still had secrets to reveal. To have such a site only a few hundred meters from the Colosseum and Forum is a marvelous thing. And that ends the broadcast today. We've run out of time. This has been the Smithsonian Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I've been reading from the April-May 2025 issue of the Smithsonian. I hope you enjoyed the program. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with its premium programming offered on a 24/7 basis. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.